traits that made sense in past ages, but cause trouble in the modern age, the knowledge illusion has its downside. The world is becoming ever more complex, and people fail to realize just how ignorant they are of what's going on. Consequently, some people who know next to nothing about meteorology or biology nevertheless propose policies regarding climate change and genetically modified crops, while others hold extremely strong views about what should be done in Iraq or Ukraine without being able to locate these countries on a map. People rarely appreciate their ignorance because they lock themselves inside an echo chamber of like-minded friends and self-confirming news feeds, where their beliefs are constantly reinforced and seldom challenged. Providing people with more and better information is unlikely to improve matters. Scientists hope to dispel wrong views by better science education, and pundits hope to sway public opinion on issues such as Obamacare or global warming by presenting the public with accurate facts and expert reports. Such hopes are grounded in a misunderstanding of how humans actually think. Most of our views are shaped by communal groupthink rather than individual rationality, and we hold on to these views due to group loyalty. Bombarding people with facts and exposing their individual ignorance is likely to backfire. Most people don't like too many facts, and they certainly don't like to feel stupid. Don't be so sure that you can convince Tea Party supporters of the truth of global warming by presenting them with sheets of statistical data. The power of groupthink is so pervasive that it is difficult to break its hold even when its views seem to be rather arbitrary. For example, in the United States, right-wing conservatives tend to care far less about things such as pollution and endangered species than left-wing progressives, which is why Louisiana has much weaker environmental regulations than Massachusetts. We are used to this situation, so we take it for granted, but it is really quite surprising. One would think that conservatives would care far more about the conservation of the old ecological order and about protecting their ancestral lands, forests, and rivers. In contrast, progressives would be expected to be far more open to radical changes to the countryside, especially if the aim is to speed up progress and increase the human standard of living. However, once the party line has been set on these issues by various historical quirks, it becomes second nature for conservatives to dismiss concerns about polluted rivers and disappearing birds, while left-wing progressives tend to fear any disruption to the old ecological order. Even scientists are not immune to the power of groupthink. In fact, scientists who believe that facts can change public opinion may themselves be the victims of scientific groupthink. The scientific community believes in the efficacy of facts, and those loyal to that community continue to believe that they can win public debates by throwing the right facts around, despite much empirical evidence to the contrary. Similarly, the liberal belief in individual rationality may itself be the product of liberal groupthink. In one of the climactic moments of Monty Python's Life of Brian, a huge crowd of starry-eyed followers mistakes Brian for the Messiah. Brian tells his disciples, "You don't need to follow me. You don't need to follow anybody. You've got to think for yourselves. You're all individuals. You're all different." The enthusiastic crowd then chants in unison, "Yes, we're all individuals. Yes, we are all different." Monty Python was parodying the counterculture orthodoxy of the 1960s, but the point may be true of the belief in rational individualism in general. Modern democracies are full of crowds shouting in unison, "Yes, the voter knows best. Yes, the customer is always right." The black hole of power. The problem of groupthink and individual ignorance besets not just ordinary voters and customers, but also presidents and CEOs. They may have at their disposal plenty of advisers and vast intelligence agencies, but this does not necessarily make things better. It is extremely hard to discover the truth when you are ruling the world. You are just far too busy. Most political chiefs and business moguls are forever on the run. Yet, if you want to go deeply into any subject, you need a lot of time, and in particular, you need the privilege of wasting time. You need to experiment with unproductive paths, explore dead ends, make space for doubts and boredom, and allow little seeds of insight to slowly grow and blossom. If you cannot afford to waste time, you will never find the truth. Worse still, great power inevitably distorts the truth. Power is all about changing reality rather than seeing it for what it is. When you have a hammer in your hand, everything looks like a nail. When you have great power in your hand, everything looks like an invitation to meddle. Even if you somehow overcome this urge, the people surrounding you will never forget the giant hammer you are holding. Anybody who talks with you will have a conscious or unconscious agenda, and therefore you can never have full faith in what they say. No sultan can ever trust his courtiers and underlings to tell him the truth. Great power thus acts like a black hole that warps the very space around it. The closer you get to it, the more twisted everything becomes. Each word is made extra heavy upon entering your orbit, and each person you see tries to flatter you, appease you, or get something from you. They know you cannot spare them more than a minute or two, and they are fearful of saying something improper or muddled, so they end up mouthing either empty slogans or the greatest clichés of all. A couple of years ago, I was invited to dinner with the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. Friends warned me not to go, but I couldn't resist the temptation. I thought I might finally hear some big secrets that are divulged only to important ears behind closed doors. What a disappointment it was. There were about 30 people there, and everyone tried to get the great man's attention, impress him with their wit, curry favor, or get something out of him. If anyone there knew any big secrets, they did an extremely good job of keeping them to themselves. This was hardly Netanyahu's fault, or indeed anybody's fault. It was the fault of the gravitational pull of power. If you really want truth, you need to escape the black hole of power and allow yourself to waste a lot of time wandering here and there on the periphery. Revolutionary knowledge rarely makes it to the center, because the center is built on existing knowledge. The guardians of the old order usually determine who gets to reach the centers of power, and they tend to filter out the carriers of disturbing, unconventional ideas. Of course, they filter out an incredible amount of rubbish, too. Not being invited to the Davos World Economic Forum is hardly a guarantee of wisdom. That's why you need to waste so much time in the periphery. While it might contain some brilliant revolutionary insights, it is mostly full of uninformed guesses, debunked models, superstitious dogmas, and ridiculous conspiracy theories. Leaders are thus trapped in a double bind. If they remain at the center of power, they will have an extremely distorted vision of the world. If they venture to the margins, they will waste too much of their precious time. And the problem will only get worse. In the coming decades, the world will become even more complex than it is today. Individual humans, whether pawns or kings, will consequently know even less about the technological gadgets, economic currents, and political dynamics that shape the world. As Socrates observed more than 2,000 years ago, the best we can do under such conditions is to acknowledge our own individual ignorance. But what then about morality and justice? If we cannot understand the world, how can we hope to tell the difference between right and wrong, justice and injustice? 16. Justice. Our sense of justice might be out of date. Like all our other senses, our sense of justice also has ancient evolutionary roots. Human morality was shaped over the course of millions of years of evolution to deal with the social and ethical dilemmas that cropped up in the lives of small hunter-gatherer bands. If I went hunting with you and I killed a deer while you caught nothing, should I share my booty with you? If you went gathering mushrooms and came back with a full basket, does the fact that I am stronger than you allow me to snatch all these mushrooms for myself? And if I know that you plot to kill me, is it okay for me to act preemptively and slit your throat in the dark of night? On the face of things, not much has changed since we left the African savanna for the urban jungle. One might think that the questions we face today, the Syrian civil war, global inequality, global warming, are just the same old questions writ large. but that is an illusion. Size matters. And from the standpoint of justice, like many other standpoints, we are barely adapted to the world in which we live. The problem is not one of values. Whether secular or religious, citizens of the 21st century have plenty of values. The problem is with implementing these values in a complex, global world. It's all the fault of numbers. The forager's sense of justice was structured to cope with dilemmas relating to the lives of a few dozen people in an area of a few dozen square miles. When we try to comprehend relationships between millions of people across entire continents, our moral sense is overwhelmed. Justice demands not just a set of abstract values, but also an understanding of concrete cause and effect relations. If you collected a basket of mushrooms to feed your children with, and I now take that basket from you by force, so that all your work has been for naught, and your children will go to sleep hungry, that is unfair. It's easy to grasp this, because it's easy to see the cause and effect relation. Unfortunately, an inherent feature of our modern global world is that its causal relations are highly ramified and complex. I can live at home peacefully, never raising a finger to harm anyone, and yet, according to left-wing activists, I am a full partner to the wrongs inflicted by Israeli soldiers and settlers in the West Bank. According to the socialists, my comfortable life is based on child labor in dismal third-world sweatshops. Animal welfare advocates remind me that my life is interwoven with one of the most appalling crimes in history, the subjugation of billions of farm animals to a brutal regime of exploitation. Am I really to blame for all that? It's not easy to say. Since I depend for my existence on a mind-boggling network of economic and political ties, and since global causal connections are so tangled, I find it difficult to answer even the simplest questions, such as where my lunch comes from, who made the shoes I'm wearing, and what my pension fund is doing with my money. Stealing rivers. A primeval hunter-gatherer knew very well where her lunch came from. She gathered it herself. Who made her moccasins? He slept 20 yards from her. And what her pension fund was doing? It was playing in the mud. Back then, people had only one pension fund, called children. I am far more ignorant than that hunter-gatherer. Years of research might expose the fact that the government I voted for is secretly selling weapons to a shady dictator halfway across the world. But during the time it takes me to find that out, I might be missing far more important discoveries, such as the fate of the chickens whose eggs I ate for dinner. The system is structured in such a way that those who make no effort to know can remain in blissful ignorance, and those who do make an effort will find it very difficult to discover the truth. How is it possible to avoid stealing when the global economic system is ceaselessly stealing on my behalf and without my knowledge? It doesn't matter whether you judge actions by their consequences. It is wrong to steal because it makes the victims miserable. Or believe in categorical duties that should be followed irrespective of consequences. It is wrong to steal because God said so. The problem is that it has become extremely complicated to grasp what we are actually doing. The commandment not to steal was formulated in the days when stealing meant physically taking something with your own hand that did not belong to you. Yet today, the really important arguments about theft concern completely different scenarios. Suppose I invest $10,000 in shares of a big petrochemical corporation, which provides me with an annual 5% return on my investment. The corporation is highly profitable because it does not pay for externalities. It dumps toxic waste into a nearby river without caring about the damage it causes to the regional water supply, to the public's health, or to the local wildlife. It uses its wealth to enlist a legion of lawyers who protect it against any demand for compensation. It also retains lobbyists who block any attempt to legislate stronger environmental regulations. Can we accuse the corporation of stealing a river? And what about me personally? I have never broken into anyone's house or snatched dollar bills from anyone's purse. I am not aware how this particular corporation is generating its profits. I barely remember that part of my portfolio is invested in it. So, am I guilty of theft? How can we act morally when we have no way of knowing all the relevant facts. One can try to evade the problem by adopting a morality of intentions. What's important is what I intend, not what I actually do or the outcome of what I do. However, in a world in which everything is interconnected, the supreme moral imperative becomes the imperative to know. The greatest crimes in modern history resulted not just from hatred and greed, but even more so from ignorance and indifference. Charming English ladies financed the Atlantic slave trade by buying shares and bonds in the London Stock Exchange without ever setting foot in either Africa or the Caribbean. They then sweetened their 4 o'clock tea with snow-white sugar cubes, produced in hellish plantations about which they knew nothing. In Germany in the late 1930s, the local post office manager might have been an upright citizen looking after the welfare of his employees and personally helping people in distress find missing parcels. He was always the first to arrive at work and the last to leave, and even in snowstorms he made sure that the mail was delivered on time. Alas, his efficient and hospitable post office was a vital cell in the nerve system of the Nazi state. It was speeding along racist propaganda, recruitment orders to the Wehrmacht, and stern orders to the local SS branch. There is something amiss with the intentions of those who do not make a sincere effort to know. But what counts as a sincere effort to know? Should postmasters in every country open the mail they are delivering and resign or revolt if they discover government propaganda? It is easy to look back with absolute moral certainty at Nazi Germany of the 1930s because we know where the chain of causes and effects led. But without the benefit of hindsight, moral certainty might be beyond our reach. The bitter truth is that the world has simply become too complicated for our hunter-gatherer brains. Most of the injustices in the contemporary world result from large-scale structural biases rather than from individual prejudices, and our hunter-gatherer brains did not evolve to detect structural biases. We are all complicit in at least some such biases, and we just don't have the time and energy to discover them all. Writing this book brought the lesson home to me on a personal level. When discussing global issues, I am always in danger of privileging the viewpoint of the global elite over that of various disadvantaged groups. The global elite commands the conversation, so it is impossible to miss its views. Disadvantaged groups, in contrast, are routinely silenced, so it is easy to forget about them. Not out of deliberate malice, but out of sheer ignorance. For example, I know absolutely nothing about the unique views and problems of Aboriginal Tasmanians. Indeed, I know so little that in a previous book, I assumed Aboriginal Tasmanians didn't exist anymore, because they were all wiped out by European settlers. In fact, there are thousands of people alive today who trace their ancestry back to the Aboriginal population of Tasmania, and they struggle with many unique problems. One of which is that their very existence is frequently denied, not least by learned scholars. Even if you personally belong to a disadvantaged group, and therefore have a deep first-hand understanding of its viewpoint, that does not mean you understand the viewpoint of all other such groups. For each group and subgroup faces a different maze of glass ceilings, double standards, coded insults, and institutional discrimination. A 30-year-old African-American man has 30 years' experience of what it means to be an African-American man. But he has no experience of what it means to be an African-American woman, a Bulgarian Roma, a blind Russian, or a Chinese lesbian. As he grew up, this African-American man was repeatedly stopped and searched by the police for no apparent reason, something the Chinese lesbian never had to undergo. In contrast, being born into an African-American family in an African-American neighborhood meant that he was surrounded by people like him who taught him what he needed to know in order to survive and flourish as an African-American man. The Chinese lesbian was not born into a lesbian family in a lesbian neighborhood, and maybe she had nobody in the world to teach her key lessons. For this reason, growing up black in Baltimore doesn't make it easy to understand the struggle of growing up lesbian in Hangzhou. In previous eras, this mattered less, because you weren't responsible for the plight of people halfway across the world. If you made an effort to sympathize with your less fortunate neighbors, That was usually enough. But today, major global debates about such things as climate change and artificial intelligence have an impact on everybody, whether in Tasmania, Hangzhou, or Baltimore. So we need to take into account all viewpoints. Yet how can anyone do that? How can anyone understand the web of relations among thousands of intersecting groups across the world? Downsize or deny? Even if we truly want to, most of us are no longer capable of understanding the major moral problems of the world. People can comprehend relations between two foragers, among 20 foragers, or between two neighboring clans. They are ill-equipped, though, to comprehend relations among several million Syrians, among half a billion Europeans, or among all the intersecting groups and subgroups of the planet. In trying to comprehend and judge moral dilemmas of this scale, people often resort to one of four methods. The first is to downsize the issue, to understand the Syrian civil war as though it were occurring between two foragers, for example. One imagines the Assad regime as a lone person and the rebels as another person. One of them is bad and one of them is good. The historical complexity of the conflict is replaced by a simple, clear plot. The second method is to focus on a touching human story that ostensibly stands for the whole conflict. When you try to explain to people the true complexity of the conflict by means of statistics and precise data, you lose them. But a personal story about the fate of one child activates the tear ducts, makes the blood boil, and generates false moral certainty. This is something that many charities have understood for a long time. In one noteworthy experiment, people were asked to donate money to help a poor 7-year-old girl from Mali named Rokia. Many were moved by her story and opened their hearts and purses. However, when, in addition to Rokia's personal story, the researchers also presented people with statistics about the broader problem of poverty in Africa, respondents suddenly became less willing to help. In another study, scholars solicited donations to help either one sick child or 8 sick children. People gave more money to the single child than to the group of 8. The third method of dealing with large-scale moral dilemmas is to weave conspiracy theories. How does the global economy function, and is it good or bad? That question is too complicated to grasp. It is far easier to imagine that 20 multi-billionaires are pulling the strings behind the scenes, controlling the media, and fomenting wars in order to enrich themselves. This is almost always a baseless fantasy. The contemporary world is too complicated, not only for our sense of justice, but also for our managerial abilities. No one, including the multi-billionaires, the CIA, the Freemasons, and the Elders of Zion, really understands what is going on in the world. So no one is capable of pulling the strings effectively. These three methods try to deny the true complexity of the world. The fourth and ultimate method is to create a dogma, put our trust in some allegedly all-knowing theory, institution, or chief, and follow it wherever it leads us. Religious and ideological dogmas are still highly attractive in our scientific age, precisely because they offer us a safe haven from the frustrating complexity of reality. As noted earlier, secular movements have not been exempt from this danger. Even if you start with a rejection of all religious dogma and with a firm commitment to scientific truth, sooner or later the complexity of reality becomes so vexing that you might be driven to fashion a doctrine that shouldn't be questioned. While such doctrines provide people with intellectual comfort and moral certainty, it is debatable whether they provide justice. What should we do? Should we adopt the liberal dogma and trust the aggregate of individual voters and customers? Or perhaps we should reject the individualist approach and, like many previous cultures in history, empower communities to make sense of the world together? Such a solution, however, only takes us from the frying pan of individual ignorance into the fire of biased groupthink. Hunter-gatherer bands, village communes, and even city neighborhoods could think together about the common problems they've faced. But we now suffer from global problems without having a global community. Neither Facebook, nationalism, nor religion is anywhere near creating such a community. All the existing human tribes are absorbed in advancing their particular interests, rather than in understanding the global truth. Neither Americans, Chinese, Muslims, nor Hindus constitute the global community, so any single group's interpretation of reality is not trustworthy. Should we call it quits, then, and declare that the human quest to understand the truth and find justice has failed? Have we officially entered the post-truth era? 17. Post-truth. Some fake news lasts forever. We are repeatedly told these days that we are living in a new and frightening era of post-truth, and that lies and fictions are all around us. Examples are not hard to come by. For example, in late February 2014, Russian special units, bearing no army insignia, invaded Ukraine and occupied key installations in the Crimea. The Russian government and President Putin in person repeatedly denied that these were Russian troops, describing them instead as spontaneous self-defense groups that may have acquired Russian-looking equipment from local shops. As they voiced this rather preposterous claim, Putin and his aides knew perfectly well that they were lying. Russian nationalists can excuse this lie by arguing that it served a higher truth. Russia was engaged in a just war, and if it is okay to kill for a just cause, surely it is also okay to lie. The higher cause that allegedly justified the invasion of Ukraine was the preservation of the sacred Russian nation. According to Russian national myths, Russia is a sacred entity that has endured for 1,000 years, despite repeated attempts by vicious enemies to invade and dismember it. Following the Mongols, the Poles, the Swedes, Napoleon's Grande Armée, and Hitler's Wehrmacht, in the 1990s it was NATO, the United States, and the EU that attempted to destroy Russia by detaching parts of its body and forming them into fake countries, such as Ukraine. For many Russian nationalists, the idea that Ukraine is a separate nation from Russia constitutes a far bigger lie than anything uttered by President Putin during his holy mission to reintegrate the Russian nation. Ukrainian citizens, outside observers, and professional historians may well be outraged by this explanation and regard it as a kind of atom bomb lie in the Russian arsenal of deception. To claim that Ukraine does not exist as a nation and as an independent country disregards a long list of historical facts. For example, that during the 1,000 years of supposed Russian unity, Kiev and Moscow were part of the same country for only about 300 years. It also violates numerous international laws and treaties that Russia has accepted and that guarantee the sovereignty and borders of independent Ukraine. Most important, it ignores what millions of Ukrainians think about themselves. Don't they have a say about who they are? Ukrainian nationalists would certainly agree with Russian nationalists that there are some fake countries around. But Ukraine isn't one of them. Rather, these fake countries are the Luhansk People's Republic and the Donetsk People's Republic, which Russia has set up to mask its unprovoked invasion of Ukraine. Whichever side you support, it seems that we are indeed living in a terrifying era of post-truth, when not just particular military incidents, but entire histories and nations might be faked. But if this is the era of post-truth, when exactly was the halcyon age of truth? In the 1980s? The 1950s? The 1930s? And what triggered our transition to the post-truth era? The internet? Social media? The rise of Putin and Trump? A cursory look at history reveals that propaganda and disinformation are nothing new, and even the habit of denying entire nations and creating fake countries has a long pedigree. In 1931, the Japanese army staged mock attacks on itself to justify its invasion of China, and then created the fake country of Manchukuo to legitimize its conquests. China itself has long denied that Tibet ever existed as an independent country. British settlement in Australia was justified by the legal doctrine of terra nullius, nobody's land in Latin, which effectively erased 50,000 years of Aboriginal history. In the early 20th century, a favourite Zionist slogan spoke of the return of a people without a land, the Jews, to a land without a people, Palestine. The existence of the local Arab population was conveniently ignored. In 1969, Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir famously said that there is no Palestinian people and never was. Such views are still very common in Israel even today, despite decades of armed conflicts against something that doesn't exist. For example, in February 2016, Knesset member Anat Berko gave a speech to her fellow parliamentarians in which she doubted the reality of the Palestinian people. Her proof? The letter P does not even exist in Arabic, so how can there be a Palestinian people? In Arabic, F stands for what in other languages is pronounced P, and the Arabic name for Palestine is Palestine. The post-truth species. In fact, humans have always lived in the age of post-truth. Homo sapiens is a post-truth species, whose power depends on creating and believing fictions. Ever since the Stone Age, self-reinforcing myths have served to unite human collectives. Indeed, Homo sapiens conquered this planet thanks above all to the unique human ability to create and spread fictions. We are the only mammals that can cooperate with numerous strangers, because only we can invent fictional stories, spread them around, and convince millions of others to believe in them. As long as everybody believes in the same fictions, we all obey the same laws and can thereby cooperate effectively. So, if you blame Facebook, Trump, or Putin for ushering in a new and frightening era of post-truth, remind yourself that centuries ago millions of Christians locked themselves inside a self-reinforcing mythological bubble, never daring to question the factual veracity of the Bible, while millions of Muslims put their unquestioning faith in the Quran. For millennia, much of what passed for news and facts in human social networks were stories about miracles, angels, demons, and witches, with bold reporters giving live coverage straight from the deepest pits of the underworld. We have zero scientific evidence that Eve was tempted by the serpent, that the souls of all infidels burn in hell after they die, or that the creator of the universe doesn't like it when a Brahmin marries a Dalit. Yet billions of people have believed in these stories for thousands of years. Some fake news lasts forever. I am aware that many people might be upset by my equating religion with fake news, but that's exactly the point. When 1,000 people believe some made-up story for 1 month, that's fake news. When 1 billion people believe it for 1,000 years, that's a religion, and we are admonished not to call it fake news in order not to hurt the feelings of the faithful or incur their wrath. Note, however, that I am not denying the effectiveness or potential benevolence of religion. Just the opposite. For better or worse, fiction is among the most effective tools in humanity's toolkit. By bringing people together, religious creeds make large-scale human cooperation possible. They inspire people to build hospitals, schools, and bridges, in addition to armies and prisons. Adam and Eve never existed, but Chartres Cathedral is still beautiful. Much of the Bible may be fictional, but it can still bring joy to billions, and can still encourage humans to be compassionate, courageous, and creative, just like other great works of fiction, such as Don Quixote, War and Peace, and the Harry Potter books. Again, some people might be offended by my comparison of the Bible to Harry Potter. If you are a scientifically minded Christian, you might explain away all the errors, myths, and contradictions in the Bible by arguing that the Holy Book was never meant to be read as a factual account, but rather as a metaphorical story containing deep wisdom. But isn't that true of the Harry Potter stories, too? If you are a fundamentalist Christian, you are more likely to insist that every word of the Bible is literally true. Let's assume for a moment that you are right, and that the Bible is indeed the infallible word of the one true God. What, then, do you make of the Quran, the Talmud, the Book of Mormon, the Vedas, the Avesta, and the Egyptian Book of the Dead? Aren't you tempted to say that these texts are elaborate fictions created by flesh and blood humans, or perhaps by devils? And how do you view the divinity of Roman emperors, such as Augustus and Claudius? The Roman Senate claimed to have the power to turn people into gods, and then expected the empire's subjects to worship these gods. Wasn't that a fiction? In fact, we have at least one example in history of a false god who acknowledged the fiction with his own mouth. As noted earlier, Japanese militarism in the 1930s and early 1940s relied on a fanatical belief in the divinity of Emperor Hirohito. After Japan's defeat, Hirohito publicly proclaimed that he wasn't a god after all. So even if we agree that the Bible is the true word of God, that still leaves us with billions of devout Hindus, Muslims, Jews, Egyptians, Romans, and Japanese who for thousands of years put their trust in fictions. Again, that does not mean that these fictions are necessarily worthless or harmful. They can still be beautiful and inspiring. Of course, not all religious myths have been equally beneficent. On August the 29th, 1255, the body of a 9-year-old English boy called Hugh was found in a well in the town of Lincoln. Even in the absence of Facebook and Twitter, rumor quickly spread that Hugh had been ritually murdered by the local Jews. The story only grew with retelling, and one of the most renowned English chroniclers of the day, Matthew Paris, provided a detailed and gory description of how prominent Jews from throughout England gathered in Lincoln to fatten up, torture, and finally crucify the abducted child. 19 Jews were tried and executed for the alleged murder. Similar blood libels became popular in other English towns, leading to a series of pogroms in which whole Jewish communities were massacred. Eventually, in 1290, the entire Jewish population of England was expelled. The story doesn't end there. A century after the expulsion of the Jews from England, Geoffrey Chaucer, the father of English literature, included a blood libel modelled on the story of Hugh of Lincoln in the Canterbury Tales, the prioress's tale. The tale culminates with the hanging of the Jews. Similar blood libels subsequently became a staple of every anti-Semitic movement from late medieval Spain to modern Russia. A distant echo can even be heard in the 2016 fake news story that Hillary Clinton headed a child trafficking network that held children as sex slaves in the basement of a popular pizzeria. Enough Americans believed that story to hurt Clinton's election campaign, and one person even came armed with a gun to said pizzeria and demanded to see the basement. It turned out that the pizzeria had no basement. As for Hugh of Lincoln himself, nobody knows how he really found his death, but he was buried in Lincoln Cathedral and was venerated as a saint. He was reputed to perform various miracles, and his tomb continued to draw pilgrims even centuries after the expulsion of all Jews from England. Only in 1955, 10 years after the Holocaust, did Lincoln Cathedral repudiate the blood libel story, placing a plaque near Hugh's tomb that reads, "Trumped-up stories of ritual murders of Christian boys by Jewish communities were common throughout Europe during the Middle Ages and even much later. These fictions cost many innocent Jews their lives. Lincoln had its own legend, and the alleged victim was buried in the cathedral in the year 1255. Such stories do not redound to the credit of Christendom. Well, some fake news only lasts 700 years. Once a lie, always the truth. Ancient religions have not been the only ones to use fiction to cement cooperation. In more recent times, each nation has created its own national mythology, while movements such as communism, fascism, and liberalism fashioned elaborate self-reinforcing credos. Josef Goebbels, the Nazi propaganda maestro and perhaps the most accomplished media wizard of the modern age, allegedly explained his method succinctly. A lie told once remains a lie, but a lie told 1,000 times becomes the truth. In Mein Kampf, Hitler wrote, "The most brilliant propagandist technique will yield no success unless one fundamental principle is borne in mind constantly. It must confine itself to a few points and repeat them over and over. Can any present-day fake news peddler improve on that?" The Soviet propaganda machine was equally agile with the truth, rewriting the history of everything from entire wars to individual photographs. On June the 29th, 1936, the official newspaper Pravda, the name means truth, carried on its front page a photo of a smiling Joseph Stalin embracing Gelia Markizova, a 7-year-old girl. The image became a Stalinist icon, enshrining Stalin as the father of the nation and idealizing the happy Soviet childhood. Printing presses and factories all over the country began churning out millions of posters, sculptures, and mosaics of the scene, which were displayed in public institutions from one end of the Soviet Union to the other. Just as no Russian Orthodox church was complete without an icon of the Virgin Mary holding baby Jesus, so no Soviet school could do without an icon of Papa Stalin holding little Gelia. Alas, in Stalin's empire, fame was often an invitation to disaster. Within a year, Gelia's father was arrested on the bogus charges that he was a Japanese spy and a Trotskyite terrorist. In 1938, he was executed, one of millions of victims of the Stalinist terror. Gelia and her mother were exiled to Kazakhstan, where the mother soon died under mysterious circumstances. What to do now with the countless icons depicting the father of the nation with a daughter of a convicted enemy of the people? No problem. From that moment onward, Gelia Markizova vanished, and the happy Soviet child, in the ubiquitous image, was identified as Mamlakat Nakhangova, a 13-year-old Tajik girl who had earned the Order of Lenin by diligently picking lots of cotton in the fields. If anyone thought that the girl in the picture didn't look like a 13-year-old, they knew better than to voice such counter-revolutionary heresy. The Soviet propaganda machine was so efficient that it managed to hide monstrous atrocities at home while projecting a utopian vision abroad. Today, Ukrainians complain that Putin has successfully deceived many Western media outlets about Russia's actions in the Crimea and Donbas. Yet in the art of deception, he can hardly hold a candle to Stalin. In the early 1930s, left-wing Western journalists and intellectuals were praising the USSR as an ideal society, at a time when Ukrainians and other Soviet citizens were dying in the millions from the man-made famine that Stalin orchestrated. Whereas in the age of Facebook and Twitter, it is sometimes hard to decide which version of events to believe. At least it is no longer possible for a regime to kill millions without the world knowing about it. In addition to religions and ideologies, commercial firms also rely on fiction and fake news. Branding often involves retelling the same fictional story again and again until people become convinced it is the truth. What images come to mind when you think about Coca-Cola? Do you think about healthy young people engaging in sports and having fun together? Or do you think about overweight diabetes patients lying in a hospital bed? Drinking lots of Coca-Cola will not make you young, will not make you healthy, and will not make you athletic. Rather, it will increase your chances of suffering from obesity and diabetes. Yet, for decades, Coca-Cola has invested billions of dollars in linking itself to youth, health, and sports, and billions of humans subconsciously believe in this linkage. The truth is that truth was never high on the agenda of Homo sapiens. Many people assume that if a particular religion or ideology misrepresents reality, its adherents are bound to discover it sooner or later, because they will not be able to compete with clearer-sighted rivals. Well, that's just another comforting myth. In practice, the power of human cooperation depends on a delicate balance between truth and fiction. If you distort reality too much, it will indeed weaken you by making you act in unrealistic ways. For example, in 1905, an East African medium called Kinjikitile Ngwale claimed to be possessed by the snake spirit, Hongo. The new prophet had a revolutionary message to the people of the German colony of East Africa: unite and drive out the Germans. To make the message more appealing, Ngwale provided his followers with magic medicine that would allegedly turn German bullets into water, magi in Swahili. Thus began the Magi Rebellion. It failed. For on the battlefield, German bullets didn't turn into water. Rather, they tore mercilessly into the bodies of the alarmed rebels. 2,000 years earlier, the Jewish Great Revolt against the Romans was similarly inspired by an ardent belief that God would fight for the Jews and help them defeat the seemingly invincible Roman Empire. It too failed, leading to the destruction of Jerusalem and the exile of the Jews. On the other hand, you cannot organize masses of people effectively without relying on some mythology. If you stick to unallied reality, few people will follow you. Without myths, it would have been impossible to organize not just the failed Magi and Jewish revolts, but also the far more successful rebellions of the Mahdi and the Maccabees. In fact, false stories have an intrinsic advantage over the truth when it comes to uniting people. If you want to gauge group loyalty, requiring people to believe an absurdity is a far better test than asking them to believe the truth. If a big chief says that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, loyalty to the chief is not required in order to applaud him. But if the chief says the sun rises in the west and sets in the east, only true loyalists will clap their hands. Similarly, if all your neighbors believe the same outrageous tale, you can count on them to stand together in times of crisis. If they are willing to believe only accredited facts, what does that prove? You might argue that at least in some cases, it is possible to organize people effectively through consensual agreement, rather than through fictions and myths. In the economic sphere, for example, money and corporations bind people together far more effectively than any god or holy book, even though everyone knows that they are just a human convention. In the case of a holy book, a true believer would say, "I believe that the book is sacred," while in the case of the dollar, a true believer would say only, "I believe that other people believe that the dollar is valuable." It is obvious that the dollar is just a human creation, yet people all over the world respect it. If so, why can't humans abandon all myths and fictions and organize themselves on the basis of consensual conventions such as the dollar? Such conventions, however, are not clearly distinct from fiction. The difference between holy books and money, for example, is far smaller than it might at first seem. When most people see a dollar bill, they forget that it is just a human convention. As they see the green piece of paper with the picture of the dead white man, they see it as something valuable in and of itself. They hardly ever remind themselves, "Actually, this is a worthless piece of paper, but because other people view it as valuable, I can make use of it." If you observed a human brain in an fMRI scanner, you would see that as someone is presented with a suitcase full of $100 bills, the parts of the brain that start buzzing with excitement are not the skeptical parts. Other people believe this is valuable. But rather the greedy parts. "Holy shit, I want this." Conversely, in the vast majority of cases, people begin to sanctify the Bible or the Vedas or the Book of Mormon only after long and repeated exposure to other people who view it as sacred. We learn to respect holy books in exactly the same way we learn to respect paper currency. For this reason, there is no strict division in practice between knowing that something is just a human convention and believing that something is inherently valuable. In many cases, people are ambiguous or forgetful about this division. To give another example, in a deep philosophical discussion about it, almost everybody would agree that corporations are fictional stories created by human beings. Microsoft isn't the buildings it owns, the people it employs, or the shareholders it serves. Rather, it is an intricate legal fiction woven by lawmakers and lawyers. Yet 99% of the time, we aren't engaged in deep philosophical discussions, and we treat corporations as if they are real entities in the world, just like tigers or humans. Blurring the line between fiction and reality can be done for many purposes, starting with having fun and going all the way to survival. You cannot play games or read novels unless you suspend disbelief at least for a little while. To really enjoy soccer, you have to accept the rules of the game and forget for at least 90 minutes that they are merely human inventions. If you don't, you will think it utterly ridiculous for 22 people to go running after a ball. Soccer might begin with just having fun, but it can become far more serious stuff, as any English soccer hooligan or Argentinian soccer nationalist will attest. Soccer can help formulate personal identities, it can cement large-scale communities, and it can even provide reasons for violence. The conflicts between nations and religions are something like the rivalries between soccer fans. Humans have a remarkable ability to know and not know at the same time. Or, more correctly, they can know something when they really think about it, but most of the time they don't think about it, so they don't know it. If you really focus, you realize that money is fiction. But you usually don't think about it. If you are asked about it, you know that soccer is a human invention. But in the heat of a match, nobody asks about it. If you devote the time and energy, you can discover that nations are elaborate yarns. But in the midst of a war, you don't have the time and energy. If you demand the ultimate truth, you realize that the story of Adam and Eve is a myth. But how often do you demand the ultimate truth? Truth and power can travel together only so far. Sooner or later they go their separate paths. If you want power, at some point you will have to spread fictions. If you want to know the truth about the world, at some point you will have to renounce power. You will have to admit things, for example, about the sources of your own power, that will anger allies, dishearten followers, or undermine social harmony. Scholars throughout history have faced this dilemma. Do they serve power or truth? Should they aim to unite people by making sure everyone believes in the same story? Or should they let people know the truth even at the price of disunity? The most powerful scholarly establishments, whether of Christian priests, Confucian mandarins, or communist ideologues, placed unity above truth. That's why they were so powerful. As a species, humans prefer power to truth. We spend far more time and effort on trying to control the world than on trying to understand it. And even when we try to understand it, we usually do so in the hope that understanding the world will make it easier to control it. Therefore, if you dream of a society in which truth reigns supreme and myths are ignored, you have little to expect from Homo sapiens. Better to try your luck with chimps. Getting out of the brainwashing machine. All this does not mean that fake news is not a serious problem, or that politicians and priests have license to lie through their teeth. It would also be totally wrong to conclude that everything is just fake news, that any attempt to discover the truth is doomed to failure, and that there is no difference whatsoever between serious journalism and propaganda. Underneath all the fake news, there are real facts and real suffering. In Ukraine, for example, Russian soldiers are really fighting. Thousands have really died, and hundreds of thousands have really lost their homes. Human suffering is often caused by belief in fiction, but the suffering itself is still real. Instead of accepting fake news as the norm, we should recognize it is a far more difficult problem than we tend to assume, and we should strive even harder to distinguish reality from fiction. Don't expect perfection. One of the greatest fictions of all is to deny the complexity of the world and think in absolute terms, pristine purity versus satanic evil. No politician tells the whole truth and nothing but the truth, but some politicians are still far better than others. Given the choice, I would trust Churchill much more than Stalin, even though the British Prime Minister was not above embellishing the truth when it suited him. Similarly, no newspaper is free of biases and mistakes, but some newspapers make an honest effort to find out the truth, whereas others are a brainwashing machine. If I'd lived in the 1930s, I hope I would have had the sense to believe the New York Times more than Pravda and Der Stürmer. It is the responsibility of all of us to invest time and effort in uncovering our biases and in verifying our sources of information. As noted in earlier chapters, we cannot investigate everything ourselves. But precisely because of that, we need to at least carefully investigate our favorite sources of information, be they a newspaper, a website, a TV network, or a person. In Chapter 20, we will explore in far greater depth how to avoid brainwashing and how to distinguish reality from fiction. Here, I would like to offer two simple rules of thumb. First, if you want reliable information, pay good money for it. If you get your news for free, you might well be the product. Suppose a shady billionaire offered you the following deal. I will pay you $30 a month, and in exchange, you will allow me to brainwash you for an hour every day, installing in your mind whichever political and commercial biases I want. Would you take the deal? Few sane people would. So the shady billionaire offers a slightly different deal. You will allow me to brainwash you for 1 hour every day, and in exchange I will not charge you anything for this service. Now the deal suddenly sounds tempting to hundreds of millions of people. Don't follow their example. The second rule of thumb is that if some issue seems exceptionally important to you, make the effort to read the relevant scientific literature. And by scientific literature, I mean peer-reviewed articles, books published by well-known academic publishers, and the writings of professors from reputable institutions. Science obviously has its limitations, and it has gotten many things wrong in the past. Nevertheless, the scientific community has been our most reliable source of knowledge for centuries. If you think the scientific community is wrong about something, that's certainly possible, but at least know the scientific theories you are rejecting and provide some empirical evidence to support your claim. Scientists, for their part, need to be far more engaged with current public debates. Scientists should not be afraid of making their voices heard when the debate wanders into their field of expertise, be it medicine or history. Of course, it is extremely important to go on doing academic research and to publish the results in scientific journals that only a few experts read. But it is equally important to communicate the latest scientific theories to the general public through popular science books and even through the skillful use of art and fiction. Does that mean scientists should start writing science fiction? That is actually not such a bad idea. Art plays a key role in shaping people's views of the world. And in the 21st century, science fiction is arguably the most important genre of all, for it shapes how most people understand things such as AI, bioengineering, and climate change. We certainly need good science, but from a political perspective, a good science fiction movie is worth far more than an article in Science or Nature. 18. Science fiction. The future is not what you see in the movies. Humans control the world because they can cooperate better than any other animal, and they can cooperate so well because they believe in fictions. Poets, painters, and playwrights are therefore at least as important as soldiers and engineers. People go to war and build cathedrals because they believe in God, and they believe in God because they have read poems about God, because they have seen pictures of God, and because they have been mesmerized by theatrical plays about God. Similarly, our belief in the modern mythology of capitalism is underpinned by the artistic creations of Hollywood and the pop industry. We believe that buying more stuff will make us happy, because we saw the capitalist paradise with our own eyes on television. In the early 21st century, perhaps the most important artistic genre is science fiction. Very few people read the latest articles in the fields of machine learning or genetic engineering. Instead, movies such as The Matrix and Her, and TV series such as Westworld and Black Mirror, shape how people understand the most important technological, social, and economic developments of our time. This also means that science fiction needs to be far more responsible in the way it depicts scientific realities. Otherwise, it might imbue people with the wrong ideas or focus their attention on the wrong problems. As noted in an earlier chapter, perhaps the worst sin of present-day science fiction is that it tends to confuse intelligence with consciousness. As a result, it is overly concerned about a potential war between robots and humans, when in fact we need to fear a conflict between a small superhuman elite empowered by algorithms and a vast underclass of disempowered Homo sapiens. In thinking about the future of AI, Karl Marx is still a better guide than Steven Spielberg. Indeed, many movies about artificial intelligence are so divorced from scientific reality that one suspects they are just allegories of completely different concerns. For example, the 2015 movie Ex Machina seems to be about an AI expert who falls in love with a female robot, only to be duped and manipulated by her. But in reality, this is not a movie about the human fear of intelligent robots. It is a movie about the male fear of intelligent women, and in particular the fear that female liberation might lead to female domination. Whenever you see a movie about an AI, in which the AI is female and the scientist is male, it's probably a movie about feminism.